Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here again with my friend Noah Gibbs. Noah is known as the author of Rebuilding Rails and of Mastering Software Technique. Noah, welcome to the show.
Good to be on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. You want to tell us about yourself?
Well, I loved when you said I was known as the author of those books, because it sort of implies that I've lied about it and somebody else actually wrote them, which is a level of intrigue I'd never even considered. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, interesting.
No, I did, in fact, write those books. But a little about myself. I've been writing Ruby for somewhere well over 10 years here. I've been writing code for 30-ish years. I get to sort of be the ancient graybeard in coding, not so much because I'm all that old, I'm 44, but because, coding hasn't been around all that long. So I can be 44 and still say, more than half the time there have been programmers in the world, I've been a programmer. And it's not even, it's not even a lie. Like, that's true.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy how young our industry is.
Like, it really is.
Yeah, like, I've been coding on the internet since, like, 96. So that's, like, 24 years. I've been programming on the web for 24 years. And that's, like, the vast majority of the web's lifespan.
96 is when most people found, when a lot of people found the web, because that was when the browser started being able to do images. Before 96, there was a World Wide Web, but there was no image tag, there were no graphics in it.
Did it start in 95? Do I have that right?
94 or 95? I'd have to look it up, but 96 is when it added images.
Yeah. Okay, so today we're going to talk a little bit about how we approach building things. We're going to try to convey, I hope, some general approaches, general principles, but per your suggestion before the show, we're going to talk about it in terms of concrete examples so that we have something specific to talk about. Okay, so dear listener, I'm going to present Noah with a feature requirement that he has not heard before this moment, and we're going to talk about how we might build such a thing. And this requirement is a real requirement from my application that I've been working on for the last 2 years. It's an EMR for a medical clinic, not just an EMR, but some of the adjacent needs like billing and that kind of stuff. In addition to, by the way, EMR is electronic medical record, in case anybody's not familiar. So in addition to the clinical stuff, does some of the business related stuff too. One part of this, you could call it a central part of it, is scheduling patients. And it's somewhat non-trivial. It's conceptually not terribly complicated, but it does, the scheduling functionality is represented in a large amount of fairly complex code. So here's basically how it works. You can think of a calendar application where you have the days, and you can schedule appointments at arbitrary times and for arbitrary lengths. This is a little bit different from that. Doctors tend to, at least our doctors, they have intervals at which you can schedule appointments. So it may be that I can only schedule appointments for Dr. Noah Gibbs between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and during that 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. interval, I can schedule appointments every 15 minutes.
Okay.
And then it may also be the case that I can schedule Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 to 4 from January 1st to June 30th, but then we switch And from July 1st through the end of the year, it's going to be Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And maybe it's 9 to 5 now instead of 9 to 4. So that's okay. The basic idea.
Yeah.
So I'll turn that over to you, Noah.
Okay. Well, so the intervals are interesting because that sounds like it's a lot of flexibility due to a customer requirement. What it sounds like I'm hearing here is doctors are persnickety about being able to choose their schedule in, you know, like that's the thing you're describing there, like that sounds like the kind of thing where doctors routinely have this kind of problems. And doctors are used to being kowtowed to. Doctors are used to getting a lot of say in how these things work. So I would probably be careful about making too many assumptions about, oh, there are intervals, I can just determine if they're free or not in that interval. And instead, I would probably use beginning time, end time, because that sounds like something where people are going to require more flexibility in the future. And converting the intervals to that sounds, you know, a little painful. I don't know. So we'll see about that. But all right, that sounds like an interesting set of customer requirements. EMR, electronic medical records. So we've got the doctor schedule. You mentioned that. We've got presumably patient info. I assume the patient info more or less already exists, that we'd be adding to it, obviously. So is the scheduling with the doctors the primary feature we're doing?
Yeah, and you know what? Why don't we say that this is an application that doesn't even exist yet, and you're being asked to build this, and you're being asked to build the scheduling component first. And I'm curious, not only the nuts and bolts of how you'd build this feature, but just logistically, would you like, and even taking into account the relationship with the person you're building it for, what would you build part of it first and like get that all deployed to production and all that kind of stuff? Or would you like build the entire thing before you showed them anything? How would you approach the whole thing?
Sure. So let me ask you, is this a small company, you know, startup-y sort of thing? Is this a larger company with a relatively established relationship with doctors? How soon does this need to start generating revenue, and how likely are we to immediately pivot if it doesn't?
Good question. So you're building this for, let's say your boss is the owner of this medical clinic.
Cool.
And the medical clinic has two doctors. They're already in business. They've been in business for a few years. Right now they're using a different EMR, but they're not thrilled with it, and so they want to gradually switch over to this other EMR. And they not only don't need to sell this EMR to anybody else, they don't want to. They want it to be specifically just for them, and let's trust that they have good reasons for that, and so we can not worry about any other clinics.
Yeah. Now, if I were actually going to do this as my job, one of the things I would be doing here is to sit down with people that have used the other EMR and take very careful notes on what they didn't like about it. Because you have just identified some killer feature that they want enough to think that it's worth putting a bunch of my time into making this new thing. If it's a clinic, you're probably also talking about a situation where their developer budget may be limited. You know, one clinic who's not going to sell this software to somebody else probably thinks of me as expensive, probably thinks of you as expensive. And so trying to produce the specific reason that they're switching over as fast as possible is a quick way to convince them that you're the good kind of expensive instead of the bad kind of expensive. Anyway, designing the feature. But you're more curious about the technical side of it anyway.
No,
if I were actually going to...
Because all these things, of course, have a bearing on everything else. So it's. I think your holistic approach is spot on.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, the first thing I do is try and figure out what feature they want that they don't currently have on the other EMR. Because if they're thinking of that as a competitive advantage, and it sounds like they are, that would be the obvious reason not to sell to other people. One likely possibility.
Yeah, it is the real reason in this case.
Yeah, that makes sense. That there are only a couple of reasons, and that's the big obvious one. Yeah. So if they're thinking of that as a big competitive advantage, you know, great. That's the kind of thing where if it were an established app, it's the sort of thing you can A/B test, right? Like, oh, you think it'll give this benefit. Here's how we measure this benefit. Let's start measuring the benefit. Now I'm going to build the thing. You start using the thing. Let's see if the benefit shows up in the metrics. Like, that could be a really tight cycle, assuming the feature is small. And there's a pretty good chance that something 95% simpler than what they eventually want should move the metric. And if it doesn't move the metric, then that's a sign that I don't know what I'm talking about, and so it's good I did the quick test because I should change my approach.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and the scheduling thing, I don't know, can you think of any of the features that they want in the new scheduler that the old scheduler doesn't have, that the previous EMR thing isn't doing well?
Well, I don't know if the okay, so I'm going to like role play a little bit here, and I'll just pretend that I'm your boss and I'm the owner of the clinic.
Absolutely.
The scheduling in the existing EMR is pretty much fine. It's okay. More that we're cobbling together several different computer systems right now, and we want to have just one computer system. One of the main things that we ultimately need is better ability to keep on top of our billing, because we, without going too deep into the whole story, we're in this constant battle with the insurance companies. The insurance companies underpay or deliberately don't pay or whatever, and we need to have the ability to keep on top of that stuff better. But in order to be able to do that stuff, we need first to be able to schedule patients in this new system, because that just happens. That just has to happen first.
Okay. So it sounds like the advantage is in terms of these reports or dashboards or something on how you're doing on insurance payments. It sounds like that's where this becomes a competitive advantage, is in terms of monitoring the insurance company's behavior. And so this sounds like integration is one of the huge things, but on the plus side, it doesn't have to be 100%. Like, if it's catching most cases, and occasionally it catches something that it's not really catching, that like it says, hey, I flagged something, and you look at it and you go, no, actually, this is fine. Some of that's not the end of the world. So that's nice. Not having to have it bat 1,000 is a really good thing to know about the design. All right. So how would I design this? This sounds like something where integration is going to be a huge part of it. Now, you say you want them to be able to sign up for it. Awesome. You're talking about a clinic with a few doctors. Signing in patients needs to be smooth and easy because you add new patients relatively often. Signing in new doctors can be terrible because how often do you add a new doctor? If you needed engineering time to do that, like, that's completely unacceptable for a commercial product, but it's probably exactly what you want to do for this. You could literally have a single RB file that hard codes the two doctors. So in the case you're talking about, I would literally start with that. Anything that can be done with, you know, 15 minutes of my time, but not making a whole interface that people have to be able to use, like, great. Skip every interface that can be skipped, especially early on.
Yeah. And fun fact, in the actual system, adding a new doctor is a terrible manual process.
Perfect.
But we've only done it like 4 times in 2 years, so.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, that sounds perfect. That sounds like exactly what I would do there. Adding new patients has to be, you know, nicer than that. But again, that's not going to happen massively often at first. And so even if that was hard-coded just long enough to get to the point where we have a few people and we can test the feature. So, okay, add them to that. Maybe you build out a UI because you need to add all the patients. Maybe you kick that can down the road and do it later. Time stuff is terrible. Time code in general is terrible. And so a few things I would do early on is make sure everything is calculated in GMT, even though you're not, you know, dealing with GMT, but all times coming into the system should be converted to GMT immediately. Your servers should run in GMT. Servers everywhere should always run in GMT. In addition to that, I would definitely, so I don't necessarily code everything test first. But there are certain things that I could test first because I look at it and go, this is trouble coming. This is test first. And things that are heavily about timing and scheduling are absolutely in that category. That kind of thing, you know, a lot of tests on time math because time math is horrible.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just so, a side note, I look at it the same way. I tweeted something the other day. I basically said, I only use TDD when TDD actually gives me an advantage. And sometimes TDD doesn't give me an advantage, and so I don't TDD in those cases. But with the scheduling stuff, I definitely, I don't know if I did test first with everything, but there's definitely very solid test coverage in this area because there's just too many opportunities for things to go wrong to not have those tests.
Yeah. Now, you described a fairly flexible input for the doctor's time. You talked about sort of between this range of time, they're available on these days at these times, this other range of the year, they're available on these days at these times. That sounds like you want to be able to input to the system in those terms, which is reasonable. But that sounds like an interface that I would definitely mock up pretty quickly. It depends how often you want to change it. Because if you're changing it twice a year and, you know, I stick it in a .rb file and if they want to change it, you know, 3 months out, they have to have me change it in the .rb file.
It's changed pretty frequently.
Okay. All right. Then that sounds like that wants to have a decent UI. Coming up with a set of restrictions that the doctors find adequate. Again, doctors are used to significant flexing in their direction. And if you tell them, oh, well, here's how you can transform it into our input format, I would not expect doctors to go for that, like almost ever.
I will say they're also used to horrible, horrible, painful software.
They are. I always assumed they just paid other people to use that for them. I could be wrong, but that was my assumption.
No. Sadly, no. They are like, doctors tend to do it like a couple different ways. One way is that they'll kind of input their notes into the system in real time. And another way is that they will see their patients throughout the day, and then at the end of the day, they will go back through all their appointments and recall, okay, this morning I saw so-and-so, this was the deal with that patient, and they'll go do all of it at the end of the day. Some doctors, if it's a doctor who does a lucrative enough specialty to be able to justify the expense, they might use a scribe who will put in their notes for them. But for the, I don't think even having a scribe like gets them away from having to use the EMR. That just ups their efficiency a little bit.
Okay, fair enough. So it sounds like that's a thing to mock up the UI of relatively early and basically present that to doctors. The nice thing about a UI for putting in your hours in particular ranges of the year is that it's fairly easy to explain, which means it's fairly easy to mock up and then sit down with them and say, hey, does this do what you want to do? And so that would definitely be one of the early components I'd do, just because it's very separatable, right? Part of the task and part of doing the task well is what pieces are necessary that you do need to build it, and you can separate it off and test it, you know, without the rest of it. So much of the difficulty of programming is just building something gigantic all at once, right? That's a separable piece, build the separable piece. And then I suppose it depends. If you've got that and you've got the scheduling and you've got them entered in the system and that's an absolute requirement, but the interesting part is the insurance companies, having them on that schedule sounds like something where you could maybe start the integration with the insurance information. Because if the value comes from that, that's an important piece. That's a useful piece, and it's a piece that should be moved as far up in the schedule as possible. I'm guessing about this. You know your business better than I do. My first thought is that you would start putting together database tables, just, you know, MySQL or something, whatever's or Postgres, you know, whatever's easy. But a relational database, definitely something where the tooling is good, because this is not going to be a massive amount of data. Like, it's individually hand-entered, it's, you know, you have a very limited number of patients and doctors. You're not going to outgrow even JSON files, let alone databases. But, you know, databases make more sense than JSON files for this, just because they're a little more convenient to query and stuff. So I'd put it into a database.
Yeah, maybe we can say, just for purposes of the conversation, so we don't boil the ocean, is like, maybe we can say the billing stuff, we can trust that stuff really can come later, and we can just treat the schedule stuff kind of in isolation. Obviously, we want to bring into the picture the things we will need to support the schedule stuff. Like, we'll need to have patients, we'll need to have doctors. But maybe let's take the billing stuff and say that we can do that later, just so we're not trying to talk about a million things at once.
Well, sure. And the reason I wind up coming back to that is one of the few areas you have hit as bringing substantial value in the short term. If your question is, how do you design this thing that is an absolute requirement to something else that we care about? My first answer is going to be quickly. I mean, okay, this is a requirement before we can get to something valuable. Fine. How fast can we do it? Because you know it's going to need some modification. You know it's, you know, gonna have to be redesigned once we actually know what we're doing. Building it out in a beautiful, gorgeous way before we can set down to the real thing is just wasting everyone's time.
Yeah, yeah, and in a real scenario, I think you would, of course, be absolutely right to bring in everything into the picture and understand, like, what do we really ultimately want this system for? What's the most valuable part? Because even if you have the whole entire discussion and talk for 3 days about all these things and really interrogate your boss on all these details, you may at the end of that decide, okay, you're right. It does make sense to build the scheduling stuff first and nothing else. But also it may turn out that your boss is wrong and it turns out we should build some of the billing stuff first instead of the appointment stuff, or we need to build the appointment stuff and a little bit of the billing stuff at the same time because it's going to be just smarter to do it that way. So yeah, in a real scenario, it's definitely a good idea to bring all that into the picture.
And so when you say that, you know, your actual literal real world employer actually literally has this thing that they think is a competitive advantage, I'm not asking you to describe in too much detail for that reason, because that sounds like the kind of thing that describing on your podcast is maybe not the wisest choice. But in a real world scenario, it would definitely be, oh, you think of this as a competitive advantage, which means you think this is worth money. Tell me how you think that translates into money, and I'm going to figure out what metric would express that and then start collecting that metric. Because that would be one of the first things. I need to be able to grade myself on whether your idea has been implemented and then worked in the real world. And if the answer is no, then we can start, you know, trying to get the small case actually working. But we have to tell if it's not working before we can fix things.
Yeah, and just as maybe a quick aside, our competitive advantage, I think, is this. So, like, every business is an IT business, pretty much. It's just whether they realize and embrace that fact. And this business does. And so we're not outsourcing that part of it. We're not outsourcing this thing that is, like, one of the most important aspects of the business, which other medical clinics do. You know, other medical clinics, even if they wanted to, they couldn't switch from an off-the-shelf EMR to a custom EMR because the switching costs would be prohibitive. The reason we were able to do it is because we had this window early on where we could, because we were small enough and nimble enough at that point in time to switch to our own EMR. And we, like, just barely accomplished it. It's like, looking back, it's like surprising that we were actually able to do it and do it successfully. But, like, if we tried to do it now at the stage we're at now, like, forget about it. There's just too many moving parts and we couldn't switch. And so the competitive advantage is, like, the marriage of our technology with everything else. The billing part is, like, an easy to explain part of that. But really the whole thing is, like, we just have everything in this system so that all this manual, it's like death by a thousand cuts every day. Mm-hmm. Like, we just have all these details to manage, and it's too much to manage without computerizing it all.
Yeah. But so when I say it's like an A/B test, a website where you're trying to convert visitors to pay you money and the kind of system you just described have a specific, let's say, a philosophical thing in common. You wouldn't use the same data structures for it, but as a philosophical thing in common, what you are doing is that you've got a core idea of the value you provide, and you've got a bunch of hypotheses in your head about how you might do it better. And you can kind of mess around and build features and hope things work, but you will, in general, be wrong about what's a good idea and how it works. I mean, I don't know where you folks are at on your website, but I know when you're trying to convert visitors to buy things from you, that's a hard problem. And it's a problem people are
and we've been wrong about a lot of things, yeah.
I would expect. Well, put it this way. You're going to keep going into diminishing returns over time because you pick the obvious awesome stuff and you do it, and you pick the obvious awesome stuff and you do it, and at some point you have less awesome, obvious awesome stuff sitting around. Like, at some point, that's how it works. That's how diminishing returns works. And so even if you were right a lot of the time early on, in some ways that would be a bad thing, because if you're right a lot of the time early on and you keep being right, at some point you're going to hit that bump where you're suddenly not right very much anymore. And man, that's a hard one for most of us to actually look at. And so if you could be in denial about it, you probably are.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Whereas if you're right about, you know, 30 to 50 to 70% of the time, you know, anywhere in there, that gives you a healthy understanding that you're wrong frequently. And so that means you, you know, understand that you need to test, but then you need some way to collect the metrics. I could, you know, I could wave my hands and give some of the nice, like, oh, well, what you need is honeycomb.io, which is a great service. But no, I mean, there are a bunch of metrics services. But the thing about metrics is that it's not all that complicated, especially if you don't have extreme requirements for it. Like if you tick up an integer in a row in a database, that's fine. Like that could totally be a metric. If you go through and you grovel through logs afterwards, like if that's the easiest way for you to do it, sure, like that totally qualifies. At some point, you may have so many guesses and so many metrics that you need to systematize that. But unless you're already at that point, don't bother with that. Do a thing that works. And if it's a kind of crude thing that works, well, that's still a thing that works. And so, yeah, when I say metrics, like if you're talking about the insurance companies underpaying, et cetera, the nice thing about that is that almost everything insurance companies deal with are delimited in either time or money, and both are very easy to measure. Like, did you bill them for a certain amount of money? How much of that did they pay? Those are wonderfully exact figures. Money is one of the easiest things to measure out there. And you do have a certain amount of like delay and stuff, which is a little harder to measure, but time is still pretty easy to measure. You know, the hard part is when you get into things like, we're generating goodwill. Well, what should that goodwill turn into? You're generating goodwill because you want it to do something. What's that thing you want it to do? We'll measure that. Yeah, and so a lot of what I'd be doing at that point would be to grade myself, to measure, you know, whether it's doing the thing I want. Because if you come to me with a hypothesis for how it should you know, for how doing something should get insurance companies to pay better, and I turn around, listen to you, and then build it, I had better have done that because you convinced me that that could work.
Yeah, here's that part in a nutshell. When insurance companies, here's how we're able to recover that money. When insurance companies underpay our insurance claims, we need to know about it. That's the whole thing. Like, and the thing is, most of these clinics, like, they're so inundated with all this work that they can't even keep on top of that stuff. They put out the charges, they send off the charges, the insurance claims, checks get mailed to them, they put the checks in the bank, and they just hope that the amount that they deposited in the bank is pretty close to the amount that their insurance claims were. And they don't have the bandwidth to know when things were underpaid. So that's the whole thing. We just need the ability to know when things are underpaid so that we can take appropriate action, whether that's appealing the claim or something else.
And if you told me that, what I would do is to start saying, huh, well, how are we storing information about how they pay us? How are we storing information about what they should have paid us? You know, the money we asked them for as opposed to what they gave us. Do we currently have any way of marking something as effectively delinquent? We need to follow up. Wouldn't add that if you don't have it, but if you do have it, then that's an important input and should absolutely get synced. And so when I talk about, let's put together a MySQL or a Postgres, you know, set of tables, like that's what I would put in those tables. To me, what you are describing there as the value of it sounds like an ETL job. Mm-hmm. Sounds like something where you have a lake of data in the middle with a couple of specific things that you care about, and you want to make sure that they're synced reasonably frequently. And at that point, what the metrics look like is, how often do we not get paid in time? How often do we notice that and raise a red flag on it? And can we make us get paid sooner? That's not something we can instantly fix, because, I mean, they pay when they pay. But over time, the hope is that that's what will come up. So that's the long-term metric. And the short-term metric is, can we flag that as they didn't pay in time quickly so that we know that's a problem?
So let's say, for the sake of the scenario, that we talk about this billing stuff and we agree, okay, that all sounds pretty good. Let's do that. Let's do it as maybe the phase two after the appointment stuff is in there. How would you approach starting with blank repo and getting to the point where you have the ability to schedule some patients? And you kind of started to describe what you're going to do. You're going to make some mock-ups, it sounds like, of the interface where you create those, whether you want to call them templates or whatever, for the doctor's availability.
Yeah, I mean, what I would literally do involves, you know, setting up probably like Bootstrap or something else, you know, for easy design, and starting to put together one or two views. For scheduling, I would even before that sit down with a piece of paper and draw a couple of mock-up interfaces. When I am entering a doctor's hours, assuming I need to do that regularly, here's where I would do it. Actually, that was one we said wouldn't happen all that often. When I am sitting down as a patient and I want to get an appointment with a doctor, here is what that looks like. And I might start with a thing where that shows the next, you know, week or 2 weeks, some relatively fixed interval of time.
Oh, sorry, just to clarify, the doctor's availabilities do change regularly. And we don't need the ability for patients to be able to log into the system at all. The patients just call and somebody at the front desk handles the scheduling.
Okay. But then I would, even if it's for the person at the front desk instead of the patient, I would do a similar thing with first just on a piece of paper. You know, here's what that interface looks like, where I put in the patient's name, I put in some amount of information about them. It pops over to here are the various slots that are available. You were talking about like four doctors. You were talking about a very, you know, tractable number of doctors. And so I might just show it for every doctor instead of letting them choose. For a quick version of the interface, one of the easiest ways to make your life better is to find conditionals you can drop, you know, things that are complicated or conditional that you can just not do. And so if you've only got four doctors, like show all four doctors, don't make them, you know, do a drop down or a select or something like that initially. Just, you know, figure out what you need to specify about the patient. And what for that, you talk to the person who's on the phone and you say, hey, like when you're going to schedule the patient, you ask who they are, you put in who they are, it pops up their stuff. How do you usually ask who they are? Do you do it by name? Do you ask for like a social security number? Like, how do you usually find this person? I assume it's by name usually.
Yeah, by name.
And so that bit, the bit they actually find based on, is the interface that actually matters. That's the bit where if it works better, that's better than if it works badly. That's the bit where if you improve the performance of it, it helps you out. And so you might consider some kind of relatively fancy text search. I wouldn't like set up an additional server on that because that's not usually worth your time. This is something where your traffic level is going to be very low, right? Like how many people do you have in the office actually messing with this? If you send an AJAX request for every letter, whatever. But you would definitely do some kind of an interesting search because good search on the last name is something that makes a huge difference while they're on the phone with a patient. And so that's probably the most important part of the form. And then if you've got the ability to say, hey, give me all the slots for the next 2 weeks, and you just do some kind of a very simple blocky static display, you're not trying to make a gorgeous calendar view, right? This doesn't need a gorgeous calendar view. If you have four columns for each day, you know, showing that, and they can just, you know, scroll through and click on that. I might not even do it with the ability to go more than a week or two in the future initially, just to get it working. Eventually you need that, but you can do that with a great big arrow on each side that's effectively a pager, right? Like there's a lot of ways you could do that. And if somebody's, you know, scheduling 6 weeks in the future and the person has to click through a couple of times and it takes a few seconds, that will be expected. Whereas the quick case that matters, the thing where you want this to be responsive to their immediate needs, is person tells you their name, they want an appointment pretty soon, you show what appointments pretty soon are available, put it in. If I was going to spend more time on polish, it would be on things like days that have no useful appointments, just don't show up, or show up in a thinned grayed out way so that they're not taking your attention, so that you can see what you actually want rapidly.
And there's kind of two sides to this. You know, there's the creation of the physician templates. And I'll just tell you the term that I use in my app. I call them availability blocks. So we have these availability blocks for the system, for the physicians, and then we have the actual scheduling of the appointments. The creation of the availability blocks happens by some administrators, the person using that part, and then the scheduling of the appointment is done by the front desk people. So could we maybe talk in more detail about how you might handle that admin side where you create the availability blocks?
When you create the availability blocks, you mean when you specify what the doctor's schedule looks like?
Exactly.
Okay, great. So the literal way you described it earlier, which is not the only way to do it, but I assume you've put some thought into this and you've talked to these doctors more than most, is you've got a range of the calendar you know, say January through July or something like that. But you've got a, you know, a chunk of the year, and then you've got days and hours available. Presumably you would need exceptions, because certainly doctors are going to have, you know, particular days where 2 p.m. on Thursday I'm busy, you know, or from 2 to 4 p.m. I'm busy. Like, that'll totally happen. But you want those to be exceptions. You don't want that to be the basic structure of the whole thing. In your case, you're talking about the 15-minute blocks, so I assume everything's going to be a multiple of 15 minutes. That's a perfectly reasonable constraint.
Sadly, no. It can be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, or 60 minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, then, yeah.
Luckily, it's never a mix.
Yeah. So time math is horrible. The obvious way to do that, given that you don't have to care too much about efficiency for most of these, like as far as just kind of determining, determining conflicts and stuff, like you're not going to be dealing with a very large number of data items, and you're not, the number of 5-minute intervals in a workday is just not that large. And so I could see breaking it up into like 5-minute blocks all through the workday. You know, it's sort of for the start of each one. The reason I mention this is you're going to want, never mind. That's not terribly useful. Because you're going to have those availability things, and you definitely want to do something to be able to get a list of those. You could try to be clever and look at lists of them over short periods of time, or you could try to be less clever and turn them into a bunch of database entries on all of the locations. And the reason that second approach tends to fall down is that if you enter it as something like, from July to December, I'm free Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, between these times, intuitively you kind of expect to be able to turn around and say, oh, hey, I was wrong about that. You know how I said 8:15? That needs to change to 9:15. And so the problem with converting it all into a whole bunch of tiny little blocks is that it's hard to turn around and then modify all of that as that entry of this range of dates, this range of times. And so if you keep it as this range of dates, this range of times, yeah, I think that's a better idea. I think that's a better idea. You have that as a way you can specify things. And if you want to break it up, you could break it up by saying, oh, hey, this specific week is different. And then you would literally have the ability to break the entry into, you know, time before, time after sort of thing. And then if you want a different set of days or something, you could do that. It is tempting to be able to have single day exceptions without having to break it up like that. Like, here's this one thing that's different.
Well, luckily the exceptions are never like, it's never usually like Tuesday the 26th is an exception or something like that. It's usually okay. The other scenario you gave an example of, like 2 p.m. on Thursday on this particular day, this one single slot is out.
Yeah. And so the first thing I'd do, because at this point I'm kind of waving my hands and going, here's how you could do it. If you have 2 to 4 doctors who are actually doing it, is I would come up with something that seemed reasonable to you for preference based on how they actually schedule and say, hey, I was looking at your schedule. It looks to me like during this set of months per year, you're available on these days at these times. If I made software where you had to specify this range of the year, these days, these times, is that going to more or less work for you, or is that not how you work? Because that can literally, you know, you can spend 30 or 40 minutes looking at their schedule, write up a little thing in 15 minutes, present it to them. And in 5 minutes, they may say, yeah, actually, you're completely wrong. Yes, it looks to you like, you know, I'm available those days a week at these times, but that's because you didn't look at my calendar here, and here, where that, you know, is completely different. So if you already have a good feel for it, if you already are pretty sure how they specify how their time is used, great, use that. But I would worry that I didn't. You know, the description you've given me sounds like the kind of thing where I could easily go off in the weeds. And it takes, you know, under an hour for me to say, this is my data model. This is how I'd explain that data model to real human beings. Hey, I'm going to talk to the 2 to 4 human beings who are going to have to use that data model and have them tell me that it either does or doesn't sound reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming they find it real.
For the scenario, we can, let's say that the person you're talking to me is, I have a complete accurate picture of how it needs to work, and we can just trust those requirements without needing to consult the doctors. And what you've said so far is basically correct. Like you said about how you would pick like the date range and the days of week and the time interval, like 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. or whatever. Can you imagine like what the form might look like that the administrator would use to create those availability blocks?
Sure. I would probably do it as kind of a drill down, where it would start with some kind of a little top bar indicating what area of the year. If I pretend that I was doing it in a cutesy way and that my design skills were better than they tend to be in reality, I'd probably have a little bar across the top where you could scroll backward and forward in the year to those areas. I assume you're not usually, like you say, going to have individual days that do it. So if the amount that you're scrolling back and forth is probably no more than four chunks per year, you know, if you just have to hit a little right arrow and a left arrow to go forward and back, that's probably fine. You know, you're never gonna be dealing with too weird a thing there. it doesn't have it. Yeah, and I'll ignore repetition for the moment. I mean, in practice, if the doctor has four different times of year with four different schedules, that's probably going to repeat. But I'm going to ignore that for the moment. I wouldn't do that instantly. If they wind up liking it, maybe I add some kind of a repetition feature. But I wouldn't do it instantly, because, again, at most, you have to deal with it about once a year. Okay, that's kind of a what chunk of it at the top. Under that, I might put sort of the 5 days of the week, and depending how nicely I wanted to do the form, I'm also assuming it's Monday through Friday, so maybe it's 7 days a week. But
doctors are susceptible to work all 7 days of the week.
Okay, well, then I'd put the 7 days of the week, and basically have probably some kind of a little check mark at the top of each day to turn the entire day off. And initially probably a start and an end bar that you could move up and down or otherwise put in the place that you wanted it.
What would the up and down bar be?
For each day, you'd like to have a start time and an end time.
Oh, I see.
When I put this form together initially, I'm describing it as though it's kind of pretty, and of course it wouldn't be. But when I was doing this initially, what I'd probably do is stick a little widget on the top that just has literally like the text January 1st, 2021 through July 1st, 2021, and a little right and left thing there. And I would probably have seven checkboxes, and I would probably arrange them horizontally, you know, for the 7 days. But the start time and the end time might even be like a select box or a text entry or something like that. Like, I would initially do this in some really rough way that would not be fine for the finished one. But that lets me start mocking up the server and then add the UI polish on top of it over time. Because essentially the, you know, two text boxes that give the time still lets me build out the server API calls, so that if I go to all the trouble of building a little slideable, draggable, you know, start time and end time, and it can send that back to the server, there's no reason that necessarily has to change the API. So basically start visually rough and visually refine. One of the things I keep finding out over and over about front-end work is that good quality front-end work, like every other kind of good quality work, is slow. Good quality front-end work is hard and requires a lot of work. When I do the initial waving my hands version, where I say, "Oh, well, you'd have the time of year across the top, and then you'd have the 7 days and the little checkbox at the top of each column to turn them on and off," mentally, we're all, you know, thinking, "Oh, yeah, there'd be different colors for the different times of year, and there'd be sort of smoothed edges, and you know, when you click the day of the week, and it's going to gray out the entire thing, and it's going to do it slowly with an animation, and we've got the start and the end bars, and they're going to have little bevels there that indicate that you should be able to click and drag them. You could make it a white box with a little bit of a gradient on it. You could do two lines across it, so it looks like a thing that you move with a switch. You know, not because you and I would do that for our first version, not because anyone would do that for our first version, but because we're programmers and we're eternal optimists. And so when we think of that, that's what a really good interface of that kind would look like. And we don't even necessarily say that we're thinking of, oh, yes, the little tab is a white box with a gradient across it and two lines and drop shadows under it, or, you know, and a drop shadow under it and two little lines there. It's that your immediate, what would that look like if I was doing a good job, already has all of that in place.
Got it.
You've used a good interface for this, and your idea of it looks a lot like mine once I've waved my hands and described the bits. But yeah, you can still do a much Sorry, go ahead.
There's that Kent Beck quote, make it work, then make it right, then make it fast. You could probably come up with an analogous quote that's like, make it work, then make it right, then make it look good.
Yes, you absolutely could.
And that's how I tend to work. I tend to like put something in there that gets the job done, and maybe it looks and works horribly, and then I step back and give it some level of polish, or maybe even completely redo the design, because maybe the process of building out that initial really rough design made me realize what the correct design should be. Or, you know, there's two distinctions. There's like multiple kinds of design. Design is such a tough word because it means so many different things. Because there's the design of how the feature works, and then there's like the graphic design that you lay on top of it. And I don't tend to go back and rework the design of how it works that frequently, because I like to get that fleshed out on paper first and do some rounds of usability testing and get that fleshed out that way, and then build it, because building it in software is expensive. Building it on pen and paper wireframes is cheap. And so I like to do that. But when I'm building things, I will do the really rough version, and then I'll come back later and add any of that visual flourish, because obviously it's, I do it that way now because early in my career, I would do it the other way, where I start with the flourish. And that's a great way to not have anything useful to show your stakeholder in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. There's also a wonderful principle that I've been told about that I keep in mind these days. So it's really easy to independently and separately build out the back-end server and the front-end. Those two aren't by any, they're not logistically required to be at anything like the same level of polish or progress. And so it's easy to wind up with this gorgeous thing the artist handed off to you, and like only 10% of it does anything at all. And it's also easy to wind up with this thing where you've built out almost the entire backend server and there's almost no polish. But if you can keep those things roughly in sync, if you can make rough screens look rough and rough features look rough, one of the things that you're doing is communicating your level of progress to people who aren't necessarily developers. I mean, a developer is going to look at a shiny, gorgeous thing and say, yeah, but does it work? Or is going to look at a, you know, terrible thing that has, you know, these horrible, like, type in text fields in a particular format and say, oh, does it do everything we want? Like, a developer understands those things are almost completely decoupled and will treat them that way. But even developers aren't perfect about that. And anyone who's not a developer, that tends to be a really hard thing to learn and keep in mind.
Well, that's
so
a really good point.
Do.
Yeah, that's a good point, because there's a very real danger in doing this. Let's say you build a feature and you make the UI look complete. You make the UI look complete and you show it to the stakeholder. And, you know, as in your career, you will have stakeholders of various levels of sophistication and intelligence. And some people, you might show them a UI and say, this is nowhere near done. Only the UI is done. I'm only a fraction of the way done with this. And they'll say, that makes sense. I understand. Other stakeholders, you might show them that and be like, oh, cool. Now all you have to do is make it work. It's almost done. And You have set this really incorrect expectation with your stakeholder, and then that puts you in a really tight spot, because maybe you're one day into a 10-day feature, but now you've set the expectation that you'll be done tomorrow, and then you get in trouble.
Yeah. Invisible work is hard, because anyone who has not done that specific kind of invisible work tends to have a really bad idea of how much work it is.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds like I'm talking about developer work, and partly I am. But, you know, the people on Hacker News who will say, Among Us looks lousy, like I could put that together in a weekend, are guilty of the same thing in the opposite direction. You don't understand how much art that is unless you've actually done some making art.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. I think of things in vertical slices. So I've worked with programmers, and I've been this programmer myself before, who like, you'll do a little bit of work on the back end and make that complete, but it's not actually connected to anything. And then you'll do a little bit of work somewhere else, and that kind of works, but it's not connected to anything else. And so you have these little like separate piles of work, but they don't really come together to achieve anything. So I like to do something more like, I have my backend part of it, you know, right down to the database, the model code, even the production server and staging server, all the infrastructure.
Yep.
And then I have the front end code that connects to that piece of the back end code. And maybe it does something really small and stupid. Like it's a form where you can put in a patient's first and last name and click save, and it saves that patient and it does nothing else, but it's complete and it works. And there's no possibility of misunderstanding what it is that you're looking at.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That can be a very solid way to do it. Yeah. That's also a great way to build out your APIs. Like if you're building a form where the form is not only crude looking, but it's not even necessarily the right thing, in the sense that you won't necessarily have a form that does that at all in the final version. Yeah, that can still be a great way to build out your APIs. And yeah, by actually standing something up end to end, you do a lot to make the invisible work visible. Because yeah, it's the same kind of problem. It's the, if you're a programmer, artwork is invisible. If you're a programmer, there's a decent chance ops work is invisible. If you're a programmer that works on one component, integration work between them is invisible. And the closest to a cure to that I've ever found is to work on things entirely by yourself often enough to be reminded that these various categories of work exist.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's way too easy when you've been working at a place where somebody else does the ops work to just completely forget that ops work is a thing that takes a lot of time. Way too easy if you work with a professional designer to not understand that just like programming has a whole lot of invisible polish work. Like artwork has an unbelievable amount of invisible polish work, or at least it's invisible if you're not paying attention.
Yeah. 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 The ops stuff is tough because that's like even more invisible than development. Like the evidence that you're doing your job is that nothing goes wrong.
And even like deployment work, you know, so much of it looks like QA work. It looks like, or bug fix work, you know, have you completely got it all working or not? It's on fire and terrible and nothing works until, you know, n bug fixes later, suddenly everything works. But there's a pretty good chance that n-3 looks almost exactly like n-50.
Yeah. It's kind of like if somebody, I heard this saying once from a sysadmin guy, it's like, if nobody can tell that you're doing your job, you're doing your job.
Yep.
But to bring it back around, the form that you described to create the availability blocks, it's really close to the way I did it. So my form, it's just an ugly CRUD form with no styling whatsoever. You pick the start date and the end date for that availability block. So maybe it's July 1st to July 31st. You pick what kind of interval length this block is, if it's a 15-minute one, 30-minute one, whatever. You pick the start and end time for this block, so maybe 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. You pick the days of the week and the location that it's for, the physician that it's for, and I think that might be all.
Okay.
Yeah, and the one difference, which is a minor difference between my way and your way, is that I think you were thinking of doing an individual interval per day, like on Mondays it's 9 to 4, Tuesdays it's 9 to 2, or something like that.
Yeah.
Mine has just one single interval, and then you pick all the days of the week, and then you could compose a schedule out of multiple availability blocks of those. I don't know if your way is better or my way is better or whatever, but obviously they both could work.
Sure. Well, and if it's for the physician availability, this is again something that happens rarely enough that if it's a little bit annoying, it's not a big deal, which is one reason that I was, you know, skipping ahead to the like scheduling a patient thing, just because that's going to happen all the time. You know, they're going to do that many times a day, every day. And so that is definitely one to squint harder at in terms of, you know, whether the interface does the right thing.
Yeah, and we probably won't have time to talk about the rest of this feature because it's kind of a deceptively large feature, even though it doesn't sound that big. But can you think of how you might store that in the database, that form we just described? When you click save, what would actually get saved?
So I would probably save it in almost exactly the form we've been talking about. These things are going to be scoped to calendar intervals. The calendar interval is going to be its own entity. It's probably got a database table for it. And the scheduling blocks for the, you know, sort of week level or day level are going to point back to that, since they are scoped to that, since they live in that interval. As a side effect, but it's the kind of side effect that I set and work out in my head just to make sure it sounds sane. If you were going to change the length of that interval so that instead of going January to July, it went like January to May, that means that it would change automatically for all of those intervals and they'd all change, which sounds like the right thing to me. As opposed to if you change it, it changes it on one scheduling block and leaves it different on the others. So you would definitely not want to give each one its own copy of that. You would want to have essentially a join to this other thing.
Wait, can you say that part again, the thing about January to May or whatever?
Sure. So I'm talking about separating the in-database objects for a chunk of the year from the ones for a scheduling block during the week. And so the scheduling block during the week would point to a chunk of year instead of having the chunk of year as part of its data representation. Does that make sense?
Maybe.
I'm talking about, so it would be possible to denormalize and copy the chunk of year into each scheduling block. And in some applications, that would be the right thing. And the way I sit and check for myself whether that would be the right thing is to think, what if I changed it? So if you change a chunk of year, then what you're doing is taking something that had previously been, let's say, January to July, and you go into the UI, however it is you change it, and you know, you go from January to July to instead being January to October or January to March. You know, you move that. So then the mental exercise goes, I just changed that. Does it change for all the blocks too? And my answer with this would be yes. Yes, it does. And so you want to denormalize, or sorry, you want to normalize it. You want to take it out of that. You want to make it a separate database object that you do a join on, which on the one hand is kind of annoying because, you know, you've got an extra join, but on the other hand is clearly the right thing to do in terms of the data representation. And since database tables are a pain to change, this is something where I would put in a little extra effort up front to make sure that I've got a fairly sane data representation, because that'll be harder to change later.
Okay. And how many tables are you thinking would represent an availability block?
Well, so you've got a table for the chunk of the year, and then you'd probably have another table for the weekly blocks. If we go with either your representation or my representation, let's see, my representation, you'd have what day it was on and what times of day it was there. Yours, you would have essentially Booleans for the 7 days of the week and what times, and you could have a number of those rows for the different blocks, like a week was Monday, Wednesday, Friday in a block in the morning and a block in the afternoon, would, with your representation, have two rows, both of which were marked one Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but one of which started at, say, 9 a.m. and went to 11 a.m. and another that started at, you know, 1 p.m. and went to 6 p.m. or whatever. And so both of those rows would point back to their chunk of the year. Let's call it a season. They would have a season ID, not because season's the right name for it, but just because it's easy to say. They would have a season ID and both point back to the same season ID because they're scoped to the same chunk of the year. So you'd have one table for the seasons and one table for the scheduling blocks for that particular chunk of the doctor's schedule for that particular season. You would have one season and N scheduling blocks. I say N because, for instance, if you had a Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning and evening one, and then you had a Tuesday, Thursday one in the middle, then you'd have three for that. So that season would have one season and three scheduling rows, three sort of appointment blocks.
Yeah, I think the way I did it, just going off of memory, is I have a table called availability blocks, and I have a start date and an end date, and then I have a, it's called like repeats on or something like that. And okay. If it's, I have the days coded 0 through 6. So if it happens on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, that would be coded as like 1, 3, 5. So sure. It would just be a string that says 1, 3, 5.
Yeah.
And then let's see, it has the start time and end time. And then, of course, a location ID and physician ID. And I think that's all that has. So it's just represented in a single, It's one table, and each availability block is represented as a single row.
Okay. So, yeah, you're then denormalizing the sort of time of year. Repeats on. I'd have to see more about how you're doing the repetition to know. I can think of a couple of things that you might call that would do different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So repeating in particular is really annoying with
that times. Was an interesting challenge. Yeah.
I used to work on Palm OS, on the Palm organizer, and while I never worked on the calendar, I sat next to the woman who did, and I've got to say, she had interesting bugs on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. There's so much. I have this list in my head of books that I want to write someday that I'm certainly never going to write because, like, only four people in the world would buy them. I have a hunch that maybe you would be one of my four readers of these books, but like,
yeah,
a book, maybe from a developer perspective, maybe not, but just on all the quirks of time, and maybe even such a book already exists. I seem to recall having seen something like that.
Well, there's some blog posts like that. Okay. I don't know if there's a book, but there are definitely sort of epic length blog posts. The usual title for that kind of thing is Falsehoods Developers Believe About Time or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there are definitely some good blog posts, and you could certainly sort of start from there and expand. I don't know how many copies of the book you'd sell, because yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing developers tend to go cheap on and assume that a blog post has everything you need on it.
Yeah, that's kind of funny.
Well, then the other way that you handle it is you do something like find a library that handles X categories of problem. You know, we don't necessarily want to write our own if we can avoid it. On the other hand, you definitely hear recommendations for time libraries. Like, I know people who have chosen Java as their language for a particular project because Joda Time exists.
Because what time exists?
Joda Time. It's the name of a well-known, highly reliable Java time library.
Got it. Okay.
Time code is hard, and system libraries for time vary widely in how reliable and how effective and how buggy they are. You know, the Ruby time libraries are nothing to write home about. Uh-huh. Active Record improves them, but it improves them a limited amount.
Mm-hmm.
Like the time libraries in Ruby, they're okay, but they're not unusually good. Neither are the built-in Java ones, but Joda Time, which is a third-party Java time library, is really good. And so if you have to do a lot of time manipulation, you might seriously consider using Java because this one library exists.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about that much. There's definitely some things that I've had to do that were non-trivial as it pertains to time. Like with this repeating stuff, these availability block intervals, they don't appear on specific dates. They do have a start date and an end date. And I actually don't call them start date and end date because that's not really accurate. Because, like, let's say it is Monday, October 19th, which today is not Monday, October 19th, but let's say it is. And then I create an availability block that has it's bounded by October 19th, 2020, and then it ends December 31st, 2020. And it repeats on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Well, October 19th isn't the start date because the first interval appears on Tuesday, October 20th.
Right.
So I don't call that start date and end date. I call that earliest possible occurrence and latest possible occurrence.
Well, that's very principled of.
Because there's so many, I figure like with all these details, it's important to get them right because like every little thing that's an infidelity from reality is an opportunity for confusion.
I love talking to engineers. Infidelity from reality is a phrase I need to remember. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That is poetry.
Well, thank you. And I realized something the other day, and I've been patting myself on the back ever since because I think it's a really smart realization. Let's say that you have 10 Ruby files in your application, and you didn't write them, so maybe you're not completely familiar with them. Maybe you only have a 90% understanding of each. And maybe the other 10% you just openly don't know, or maybe the other 10% is a misunderstanding, but your mental model of that file is only 90% accurate.
Yep.
Well, And let's say this is a program that only has 10 files total. You understand each with 90% fidelity. Well, then what's your understanding of the whole program? Your understanding is 90% of 90% of 90%. So it's 90% to the 10th power.
See, I see where you're going with that, because all 10 files have to work. And if there are bugs in random places, then as you say, you know, everything has to work. I would say it's more complicated than that in reality. Let me give you an example of why.
Let me just give you the last percentage real quick before you share that thought. So if I understand these 10 files with 90% fidelity, then 90% to the 10th power is only 36%. And that's a terrible, abysmal level of understanding of the whole thing. Now, I concede that you're completely right. It's more complicated than that. But I think the principle is true that if you have these small infidelities from reality, as I said, and in a real application, you have opportunities for hundreds, maybe thousands of these. And if there are enough of those, then your mental model of the whole program will just be completely screwed. So that's my thought.
No, it's a good thought. I'll also say that your mental model of that is in some ways the worst case mental model, and I mean that in a good way, because of course you're trying to figure out the worst case as an engineer. That's often your job. If your understanding of each file is 90%, and that 90% is spread evenly like a transparent layer across the entire file, so that you have a 90-ish percent. Imagine you zoom in fractally. What you're talking about is, what if you zoom in fractally and it's still about 90%, as opposed to, you know, real understanding, which tends to be really strong in some areas of the file and really weak in other areas of the file. And you're also assuming that calling through is kind of an undifferentiated, it'll go through all 10 files eventually. And so there's, you know, you've got a 90% chance of it working as you go through each one. You're kind of using gauzy curtains as your mental model of how errors and bad understandings work. In some ways, the real case that's more complicated is still more hopeful, because there's a really good chance that you prioritized your understanding according to the important and frequently used bits of each file, and there's a really good chance that if the author of those 10 files, which isn't necessarily you, knows what they're doing, they are keeping the modularity, the actual links between those files, handled in a sensible way. If one of those files is a printer driver, on the one hand, it may be terrible. Like your understanding of that printer driver may be extremely low, both because printer drivers tend to be annoying and hard and full of weird edge cases, and also because you're going to prioritize that a lot lower so you won't look through it. But on the other hand, a printer driver is a great example of an omega mess, as Sandy Metz would put it. It's a great example of something where you probably don't have to touch it very often. You probably don't mostly need to understand it. And if it fails, it's kind of nicely separated. It's this horrible thing, but it's a horrible thing that you can put boundaries around. Whereas if you have some central dispatching mechanism that everything in your app goes through, let's say an event loop for a GUI, and that is extremely poorly structured. Like, it doesn't matter if your understanding is 97% rather than 90%. Like, having that right in the middle where everything goes through it is horrible.
Yeah. I think the significant thing there is the interconnectedness of each part. Because if you understand two things with 90% accuracy, then you understand everything with it. If you understand two things with 90% accuracy and they don't affect each other at all, they're completely isolated, then you understand everything with 90% accuracy. You can sum those things. But if there are two things that are interrelated and depend on each other, and you understand those each 90%, then you multiply.
Yeah, exactly. And so, a lot of good systems design is repeatedly looking at a project and saying, how can we structure this so that I don't have to be even as intelligent as I had to be last restructure? What can we do to make it acceptable for me to be dumber here?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. And I've never consciously, explicitly phrased it to myself that way. But that's exactly the approach I take. By the way, just to be needlessly pedantic, I said something wrong a second ago. You don't sum those two 90% if they're independent. You would average them. Anyway, when I refactor something, I want to lower the cognitive load so that I, like you said, don't have to be as smart as I was the last time I looked at this, because it's like we have this limited brain power that we have to use up all day every day, and I run out of brain power well before I run out of time in a day usually. The problem is not too little time, it's too little mental energy. And I don't want to waste any of that mental energy, because that's like my bottleneck. That's my most precious resource as I'm working. And so if I can make the code easier to understand, so it only requires half as much brain power to grasp it as it did before, then that's a huge win that's going to pay off every time I look at that code.
Well, this is less hopeful than some of the other things I said earlier, but it is at least a very human kind of less hopeful. You're going to keep getting older, and you may stay a developer as you keep getting older. Some people do. And so before long, what you need to be doing is looking at a particular project and saying, I'm going to be a lot stupider 5 years from now, and I'd like this thing still to work. What can I do to make it so that me in 5 years is still smart enough to maintain it?
Hopefully, I don't start to get stupider very soon. I think,
As far as I can tell, I've long since passed the point where I'm going to be able to increase my overall mental speed, cleverness, and capacity to solve problems. Like, for just raw horsepower mentally, I have clearly hit my peak. And while I'm not coasting downward rapidly, like I'm not dropping quickly, the path doesn't go up from here, it goes down. I've gotten a lot better at being clever on some things. I have a lot of, you know, things that I've worked out ahead of time, and I can reuse those things that I've done. But of course, that's always a bit of a race, right? Continuing to build assets that make you effectively smarter at a rate faster than your cognitive decline. You're already counting down. You may have a long count ahead of you, but you're counting down, and you should definitely schedule your own time on this earth as though you are counting down instead of up from here forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had kind of an obsession over my life with like trying to figure out how to make myself smarter. And what I've discovered is that, unfortunately, my understanding is that you can't increase your G, which is your cognitive horsepower. You're just born with so much of it, and that is static over your life.
If it helps, it's worse than that, because G is not a thing that can reliably be measured, and it's not even clear it exists. But go on.
Oh, okay. But you can increase your level of knowledge, of course, and you can increase your judgment and your wisdom. And so that's good. And that's my hope, is that even if my horsepower declines over time, I can compensate for that, and hopefully more than compensate for that with those other three things, the knowledge, wisdom, and judgment.
That's the hope. Of course, capitalism is here with another reason to be less hopeful, and I'll just put this out here. You talk to a lot of people who like the idea of increasing their impact on the world, changing the world, as we used to say several levels of jadedness ago. If you succeed in doing that, in the happy, wonderful case where you get to do more to change the world and more to affect your own working conditions and your own, you know, everything, you're going to have less and less time for the kinds of things that you currently spend your time on, because you will have more important things come up, which means even if you can improve fast enough to keep cognitive decline from hitting, you can't improve fast enough to keep your priorities being elsewhere from hitting. You're just not going to have as much time to maintain this thing as you used to, because you will have more important things in mind. And that's in the best case. Capitalism and its various relatives, like, you know, increasing your rank for other reasons that aren't directly about earning money, all conspire to make sure that you're not going to have the amount of time, attention, and brain power to put into this thing that you do right now. That's going away.
Yeah,
you're going to have to do it with, you know, 40% of your attention before too long.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I'm thinking of that Shakespeare quote, nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. But like,
I love that one.
Yeah, it's so true. But like, if you find something in life that is truly important work, worthwhile work that you want to spend your time on, then it is likely to consume a good slice of your time, and you'll become increasingly judicious about how you spend your time because you're like, no, I don't want to do that BS over there because that's not going to move the needle in any meaningful way for anything. That's basically just a waste of time. I'm going to spend more time on this meaningful thing that I enjoy. And it's like, let me think of an example. I don't know. Like Robert De Niro is probably only ever going to be an actor. He's probably not going to at some point start being a scientist also and accomplish both those things in his life. There are some people who have, you know, there's like Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, those people who are polymaths and have had great achievements in multiple areas of life. But for most people...
I was going to say Hedy Lamarr. There are people who have literally been an actor as well as that. Hedy Lamarr also invented frequency skip radio transmission.
Oh, interesting. Yep. I haven't heard of that person. I'll have to look.
Well, she was an actor a long time back. But yeah, H-E-D-Y, Hedy Lamarr.
Interesting. Yeah, and those people fascinate me, but for most people, you're probably going to have like one thing in your life that you spend, but that's like, is that good or bad or neither? Because like, that's great. If you can find something that is worthy of spending like the majority of the years of your life and the time in your day, then you probably found something really worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, and yet actor, like developer, is one of those things that you describe it in a static way, but it's a very dynamic thing. I suspect what Robert De Niro spends his entire day doing at this age is a little different from what he did when he was 25 and an actor.
True.
I don't remember for sure that he was 25 and an actor, but I assume Robert De Niro's been at it a while.
Yeah.
So in the same way, if as a developer you find ways to make yourself more effective as a developer, let's say you don't change category, you're still a developer, but you still get to be a better and better developer, I'll say the way it works professionally is you spend less and less of your time on the stuff you did early on, and you are a more effective developer because you change the nature of what you do. Or to put it another way, you talk about how you spend all your time on this BS. If you find higher quality uses for your time, you are in the continuous process of transmuting every existing use of your time to useless BS.
Wait, say that again?
If you find higher quality uses for your time, that means you are in the continuous process of transmuting all your current uses of your time into useless BS. Hmm. You are increasingly turning them into something where you have a better use, and you should now resent having to spend time in those ways because there's something better you could and should be doing.
Yeah, that's true. I have somewhat of an aspiration to turn all my time into useless BS because that just sounds
excellent.
Fun.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. All right, maybe that's a good place to end it. I will leave you, Noah, with an invitation that you don't have to answer to now, but my invitation to you would be if you come up with a feature and then ask me how I would build it. Hopefully it's something web-related because I think it might not be very interested for anyone listening. If it's not, just because I might not have anything very smart to say about something that's not web. So that's my invitation to you. But before we go, last question, where can people go to find you online?
So my Twitter handle is Codefolio, CodeFolio. My personal website is Codefolio with a .io on the end, so CodeFol.io. Yeah, those are probably the first places to go. Alternately, if rebuilding Rails, learn Rails by building your own framework, sounds interesting, you can just type rebuilding Rails into Google. It's good at finding that.
Noah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. And yeah, I'd love to talk to you about a feature. And I think I may go with the same one we mentioned earlier. I would love to talk to you about sandboxing. Do you remember TryRuby and Hackety Hack?
I do not, and I'm somewhat terrified.
Well, it's a thing Why the Lucky Stiff originally did, and I think Steve Klabnik may maintain it these days. But the basic idea is you pop open a browser window and it lets you run a little Ruby session. It lets you, you know, type code into Ruby and it calculates it and spits the results out. It's basically IRB over a browser. And so when you and I talked about sandboxing and how sandboxing is hard and how this weird thing called DGD that I've been looking at is designed to let hundreds or thousands of people put semi-trusted code in and have it run all in one server, and that's a weird thing. Most languages are terrible at that. Hackety Hack is a great example of another thing that has done that, and there aren't many because sandboxing is really freaking hard.
Got it. Now that you mentioned, I have heard of Hackety Hack, and I never understood what it was. I have very low faith in my ability to to come up with any intelligent comment on how I would build such a thing. But my invitation still stands. Whatever you want to throw at me, I'll happily give it a swing.
Cool. Well, thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
You too. Talk to you later.